Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we explore different aspects of the world of music, including album reviews, concert reviews, and what I'm bringing you today, this week in music history. And of course, we are going July 16th through July 20th. A great week, if I do say so myself. But before we get into that, if you would like to help us out on this podcast, please go to our website at followthesoundpodcast.com and click on the Amazon banner. If you click on the Amazon banner, it'll take you to Amazon. And as of the day we are recording this, it is Prime Day, which means there are a bunch of great deals out there that you can always go check out. But go there, do all of your normal shopping, and then we get a little bit of money just for you going and buying stuff through Amazon, but going through our website first. So click on that banner on our website, or just go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. And of course, go check out YoRadio.com. YoRadio is the latest and greatest music app that you can get on Google Play or on iTunes. Go there, click on a radio station, and you will be able to listen to music for free, and it's that simple. It's just a completely free music app out there for everyone to enjoy. And in a bit here, of course, I've been talking about it before, we will have our own radio on YoRadio.com. So please go check it out, YoRadio.com, or download the app on Google Play or iTunes. Now, this week in music history, July 16th through July 20th. To help me on with this great week of music history, I have, of course, Jacob Crum.
Hey, how are you?
And Greg Harvey.
Hello there.
I missed you guys. I know it's been a couple weeks.
It has. Hey, I have great news.
Yes.
I've recently reached OT2.
Okay.
And I just learned about the law of manifestations.
Nice.
Okay, it's a three-part triangle, Brian. See, first, you have to visualize what you want. Okay, that's an image, a picture in your head.
Then
you
first
have to,
triangle.
Yeah, you have to decide. No, it's just one triangle. Three sides to a triangle. You know what a triangle is.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the Triforce.
No.
A peanut butter
and jelly
sandwich.
Well, that's three triangles.
That's three triangles.
No, I'm talking about the law of manifestation. Okay, and then
but
you make decisions. You have to decide to change your actions, because without change of your actions, you're just going to stay where you are.
So I'm going to make a peanut butter.
And then third, you have to believe. This is the underlying law in pretty much all religions. It's really simple.
I believe I'm going to make myself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
There you go. And how are you going to find that peanut butter? You got to visualize where it is in the cabinet.
It's at Shop and Save.
The top shelf where your grandmother keeps the peanut butter.
It's in the peanut butter aisle.
It is in the peanut butter aisle. I don't have peanut butter in the house right now, though. I have almond butter, not peanut butter, though. On that weird side note of the great path of Scientology that Jake is presenting to us, he is just covered in body thetans right now, and he is terrified of Xenu. But that's beside the point.
It's actually Zimu.
I know it is.
Okay.
but let's get into music history, starting off with July 16th. What do we got first?
Let's start in 1959 when the Coasters on this day recorded Poison Ivy.
The minute you start to mess around, Poison Ivy.
I like that.
Yeah, you didn't think they could put they could rhyme calamine lotion. They managed to do it.
Yeah, that's true.
They did do that.
Motion lotion. Ooh, man, I wish. I like that kind of music. I wish the people still made stuff like that.
What, just like novelty songs in general, or
no? I just kind of that like roots.
Oh,
rock, just that bump. Do 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 do.
They were an interesting group, the Coasters, because they were kind of like a doo-wop group, but they weren't a doo-wop group. Like, they did rock, they did blues, they kind of straddled a couple different genres to create their sound.
No. Well, yeah. Good song. Good song.
It is a very good song. I like that one quite a bit, actually.
Well, let's evolve in the rock and roll genre here a little bit. Our next one is from 1966. One of rock's first supergroups is formed, Cream. Its members are Jack Bruce, Eric Clapton, and Ginger Baker. Cream. Remember Sunshine of Your Love. Or
Cream
in
is
a
definitely
white room.
Oh yeah.
With black curtains near the station.
Cream is definitely one of these bands that just is in history as, like, one, it was a super group, really. Because they'd all kind of bounced around in other bands. But the, like, three just top notch musicians. You know, especially with Clapton and Jack Bruce. But Ginger Baker, like the madman on the drums, who like basically claims to be the greatest rock drummer of all time. And just like was, I mean, completely insane. I mean, he still is. He's still alive, which is just cracking me up even more. It's like he should have died a while ago. But yeah, no, Cream is one of these groups that you can really just listen to any song of theirs and be like, man, this is so well done. And for them to be just the three of them and make that powerful sound, it was amazing in its time.
That is impressive to have like a trio that really fills out like that. That's always been one of the more impressive things in music is when it's like just one guitar, one bass, and a drummer, and then you like just write these killer songs. But
yeah. Well, moving on up 1 year, Arlo Guthrie debuts Alice's Restaurant Massacre. Yeah, that's what it says. At the 1967 Newport Folk Festival, the song runs 18 minutes long and tells a true but greatly exaggerated story about how he was arrested one Thanksgiving morning for illegal dumping. The ticket later made him ineligible for the draft, keeping him out of the Vietnam War.
What? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So, you got a ticket for illegal dumping. And that made him ineligible for the draft? Wouldn't that, like, automatically qualify you for the draft or something? I'm just saying.
It sounds like to me like they would just recruit criminals who did weird things like that, and they're just like, we're going to send you over to Vietnam, where you can just dump all over the place.
Yeah.
You're in waste management. Figure out a place to just throw all of this stuff away.
Well, young Mr. Guthrie, I heard you're a fan of dumping garbage where you shouldn't. Well, you know where you can go? You go to a garbage place like Vietnam, and you could dump napalm all over them fools. How about that? You're in the army now.
That's what I'm saying. Why would he be...
I don't know where I'm going with this.
Why would he
I don't know. That was pretty good.
Ineligible for the draft because of that. That doesn't make sense to me. Like, oh, he's a troublemaker. We can't send him... Can't send them to war.
Well, they might have had something about it, like, you know, you couldn't, if you were charged with a felony or something, you know, but I don't think that's a felony, really.
I mean, felonious dumping sounds like
it
could be a thing.
I don't know. On a weird side note, though, I did read today about how Jimi Hendrix was kicked out of the army because of the love of his guitar. Yeah. I'm not joking. Like, it was actually reported from his commanding officers that basically if he didn't have his guitar, that he was useless. And he did a bunch of other stuff, too. Like, whenever he didn't have his guitar, he would go out and just get completely hammered and then sleep until noon. So, yeah, he got kicked out of the military, like, because he basically loved his guitar too much.
Huh. Actually, I think if I'm remembering this, the way the story is told correctly. So, like, Arlo Guthrie was on the tail end of, like, being too old to be drafted, and I guess I'm pretty sure he didn't pay the ticket, so he was actually put in jail long enough for him to be old enough that he didn't have to register with the draft board.
Okay, so maybe this was an elaborate scheme.
I mean, on his part, it's probably a pretty good scheme, honestly.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. On that note, in the year 1972, Smokey Robinson performs his final show with the Miracles. It was at the Carter Baron Amphitheater in Washington, D.C. At the end of the show, Smokey introduces his replacement, the 20-year-old Billy Griffin.
And I have no idea who Billy Griffin is.
The prodigy, the legend, Billy Griffin, everyone.
I'm just saying, like, you can't replace somebody named Smokey with somebody named Billy. Like, you can't go from a cool name to, like, a normal name.
Yeah, but you also can't just arbitrarily try and give someone a nickname for no reason.
Yes, you can. It's the music industry. They do it all the time.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
You are now ampersand, ampersand, ampersand.
Just say, like you can come up with other. It's like there's other phrases, you know, like smoky, you know, stormy. Stormy Griffin.
How about steamy?
Steamy Griffin.
Steamy Griffin.
That's not Stevie Nicks. That's Steamy Nicks.
But how often do you actually see someone?
What is that, like the steampunk version of Stevie Nicks? Oh. Steamy Nicks. It's like a robot, steam robot.
Ooh, there you go. I was thinking on South Park where Steamy Nicks, she just gets on stage and fills her britches. And then, of course, they decide that they have to save the pants from the britch filling. Anyways, birthdays. Happy, happy birthday.
Yeah.
What do we got?
Oh, man. Let's see here. Birthdays. 1911. Geez, that's a while back, isn't it? Yes, in 1911, the one and only Ginger Rogers is born Virginia Catherine McMath in Independence, Missouri. She begins her partnership with Fred Astaire in 1933, RKO Flying Down the Rio. That's a musical. Yeah, I like that. What is the
RKO? Is that like the production company?
Yeah. That was a production company back in the day. I forgot what it stands for.
So the 1933 RKO musical,
yeah.
Flying Down to Rio.
Yes, yes, yes.
I see.
So, yeah, but she was... See, there you go, right there. Giving a person a random nickname. Like, oh, I don't know. She might have had that nickname all her life.
What, Ginger Rogers? Like
she
her
definitely
stage name?
Yeah. But it's just funny because, you know, in the movie industry, they would just change people's names constantly just to not be associated with somebody else. And it's still that to this day. Like, you've got people who are, like, named the same thing as other actors, and so you can't actually go in there with that same name. You've got to change your name.
Yeah, that's
to
something, or Screen, like, Actors Guild.
Yeah,
guild
or you've got to have, like, add an initial or something like that. But, I mean, like, you look at even outside of acting, it's still you've got different, you know, that's why we've got a Michael Jordan in basketball and a Michael B. Jordan actor.
Interesting.
Also, if you want to talk about another movie crossover for that, most people don't know who Katie Hudson is, but she changed her name because she didn't want to be associated with Kate Hudson, the actress, and she changed her last name to Perry.
Oh.
But her real name is Katie Hudson, and she actually has an album released under Katie Hudson. It's a Christian album.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious. And then her brother also has a band named Hudson. So,
How much of that album have you listened to?
All of it.
Is it any good?
No.
What, the album Hudson or the Katy Perry one?
Hudson is good. Hudson is a good band. They're more Americana kind of stuff than like rock or anything. But yeah, no, her album, her Christian album is pretty bad. I mean, it's
poorly written.
No, it doesn't seem to have any kind of flow to it.
Yeah,
it was sort of thrown together, like
it was just her earliest work, you know, before she actually like started doing the big stuff.
Yeah, and then later on, when she'd like moved out to California, she changed her name to Katy Perry, which is her mother's maiden name, and then she started writing music, and then that's when she wrote like You're So Gay and You Don't Even Like Boys, and then I Kissed a Girl, which became a super hit. So,
my favorite Katy Perry fact is that her cat's name is Kitty Purry.
Thanks for that, Greg.
Yeah.
But speaking of people who moved to California.
Oh, okay, okay.
Sorry. Well, so there you go.
We get sidetracked by Katy Perry, but I can't spout an interesting kitty fact about Kitty Purry.
Look, if I don't have my disdain, I have nothing.
All right.
So 1925, we got another birthday, Latin jazz musician Cal Jader. He was born in St. Louis, Missouri, but his vaudevillian parents moved him to San Mateo, California. And he, at age 16, he won a Gene Krupa drum solo contest. I could not find a recording of him actually doing the Gene Krupa song Drum Boogie. So instead, here is something from Fried Bananas. It's not just elevator music.
Well, that was
it's
pleasant.
Jazz.
That was nice. That see, that's that that nice like West Coast jazz. So for those of you who don't know, jazz was mainly like throughout the South, and then it kind of immigrated north to Chicago and New York, and like mainly a lot of New York stuff where it was where it transitioned into bebop. And a couple of other things, and there's big band and all that. But then out west, it transitioned into this super mellow, like, stuff like that, where they were using, like, a xylophone or a vibraphone or something along those lines to get that nice, soft sound.
It was very, very, like, California dreaming, just kind of.
Yeah. And in New York, like it was all rhythmic daydream. And, like, you know, over the top and fast, you know. It's like, you know. But, yeah, out there, it was this really sort of composed thing. Like, you know, yeah, there was improvisation in it, but it was, like, a really heavily composed thing. Yeah.
There's
your weird history of jazz for the day.
Ooh.
This is one of those albums that I left off my list to put on Yo Radio. That I kind of kicked myself for, because like Fried Bananas is a really good album.
Yeah.
But we do have a decent substitute for it. There's a French band called Air, and their album Moon Safari is it's in the same vein, and it's pretty good.
Nice. I like it.
All right. Well, now we are on to a new day, gentlemen.
July 17th in the news, 1939. Charlie Barnett records the jazz standard Cherokee. Which has become something of a rite of passage for many musicians. It is a well-known song. I'm surprised you didn't pick that one for me to play.
Hmm? I did give you a clip of this one.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's okay. I did not pick a Charlie Barnett version.
Oh, okay,
version.
Okay, yeah, okay, yeah, you did. Okay, got that. No, you picked a different version.
Yeah, this is Max Roach, because it's my favorite version.
All right, well, we're going to play a little bit of this one then. Let's do that. I could just keep listening to that.
Yeah.
But that's what I was talking about. That's that fast, that upbeat, you know, like hard-hitting kind of stuff.
I know. I was paying attention to that drummer going...
Well, that is Max Roach, who is like one of the greatest jazz drummers of all time.
That was a cool beat. Real cool beat.
Like, if you ever get a chance, actually check out Max Roach versus Buddy Rich.
Oh.
Like, they did a few of them. Mm-hmm. I think they did like a couple of those of albums. And it's literally them back to back recording the same song.
Huh.
It's just, here's one with Max Roach, and here's one with Buddy Rich. And it's just back to back of just that. And it's amazing.
Wow.
Because you get to hear the, like, when they're doing the standard stuff of just keeping the beat, like you get to hear the subtle differences between the two of them. But when they go into like their actual solos, it's just amazing. some of the best drumming ever recorded.
I would love to hear that. We should do that sometime.
I will.
All right. Well.
All right, what do we got next?
1954, the Newport Jazz Festival, the world's first jazz festival.
Yeah.
Debuts on the tennis courts of the Newport Casino in Rhode Island.
Yeah, I mean, that's still going on, isn't it? The Newport Jazz Festival, that's still like a thing that's continuing.
Well, it
that
was
seems weird
the
to
Newport
me.
Jazz. No,
okay, jazz, and then it became
folk, and then folk and pop, and then...
Now it's just like the Newport Festival or something like that, isn't it?
I guess.
I don't know. I'm going to have to look this one up. Talk amongst yourselves.
Well, I think that the fact that the world's first jazz festival was in Newport, Rhode Island does seem kind of strange to me. I'm not sure, like, what the jazz scene was there. Because, like, jazz is so New Orleans, you know? Yeah. That's what I think.
No, it's
New Orleans.
It's still listed as the folk festival. So the Newport Folk Festival, happening July 27th and through the 29th in 2018 in Fort Adams, Newport, Rhode Island.
So same festival, different name.
But, yeah, they... So, okay, now this isn't just folk. This is like a bunch of different, like, even like indie rock groups and stuff like that. Here's Gary Clark Jr.'s playing. Wait, Cheech and Chong are going to be there?
Sweet.
Cheech and Chong are going to be there. Are they playing songs? If so, are they going to play covers or are they going to do their own stuff?
Mexican Americans.
Are they going to do the song that they played at the beginning of the Corsican Brothers?
What is
I don't know, but yeah, there's a lot of folk artists, but there's also like a couple of people in here, like Sturgill Simpson's more of like a country artist. St. Vincent's on here. Like
it sounds like it's just a good time.
This is a pretty fantastic lineup, actually.
I think Brian just found his new festival.
The Lone Bellows playing there, and I freaking love the Lone Bellow.
Wow.
They're like one of my favorite groups right now.
Wow. All right. All right, well, I'm going to go ahead.
Hang on.
Oh, Shaky Graves.
I love Shaky Graves.
Yeah.
He's outstanding. The Newport Casino is still there.
Woo!
And houses the International Tennis Hall of Fame.
Ooh.
Of course.
Because that was the site of the first U.S. Open.
Ah.
So there you go.
Well. All
right. That is a nice little tidbit of history.
I'd like to go down there just with, like you know, like a bongos and a strum stick.
A djembe.
Yeah, and stand on the tennis courts and just, like, play for an hour. Anyhow.
You get those people who really pronounce the D in the djembe?
Well, let's get a cajon.
Oh, God. That's the most pompous thing. I hate that.
Like, oh. Do you really? I want one so bad.
No, I don't mind congas. I hate people that, like, pronounce that are heavy on the D in djembe.
Oh.
It's like, oh.
Djembe.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
It's like, gee, this instrument only has a 5,000-year history and it's been pronounced basically the same way the entire time. It's been called a djembe. You don't say the D.
All right. You ready?
Go for it.
1967.
Woo!
Jimi Hendrix. He played his eighth and final show as the opening act for The Monkees.
Yes!
Which understandably doesn't go well because Monkees fans want nothing to do with Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, this is like gone down in history as one of the worst like pairings in a tour ever. I'm sure somebody's done it worse than that, but man, it just cracks me up because they talk about this in every documentary that involves the Monkees. They're like, well, we were out on tour, and it's like, I was a big fan of Jimi Hendrix, and so we got him on for the tour. He's like, and there he is, like, busting out Purple Haze, and they're just screaming at the front, you know, like, we want Mickey! We want...
Yeah.
We want Davey!
You suck!
It really says something either about the laid back nature of the times, like everyone was just so high on psychedelics.
Yeah.
That they let that go on for eight shows, or everyone's like, look, Jimmy is so talented, he's going to find a way to win him over.
Yeah, everybody loves this kid.
Because, like, that doesn't happen. Nobody does that now. Nobody who has that much leash to do eight shows where the crowd hates you?
I don't know. But going back one thing with the Newport Jazz and Folk Festival, because as it is also well known that Dylan played electric for the first time at the Folk Festival. He did the first part of his set acoustic and then brought on all these other musicians to play loud rock music, and the crowd revolted.
Oh, no.
They hated it.
Wow.
With a passion. And if you ever go back and watch footage of that, it is absolutely hilarious watching these people just like completely freak out that Dylan started playing electric.
Wow. You know, that's funny. I might have told you guys this before, but I remember one time I was invited to do a talent show.
Yes.
And of course, I'm a drummer.
Yeah.
And so this kid was like, let's play Green Day. Let's play punk rock stuff for this talent show, because that's what he wanted. And I said, sure, buddy, I got your back. So we practice. Day of the talent show comes. Turns out we were the only act that was not a guy with an acoustic guitar. And we played our music, and the judge's response was, you guys were way too loud, and we got eliminated in the first round. And it was like, well, we've got a full band. That was their only feedback. You guys are too loud.
I had the same response when I was in gospel choir in high school. We went to a gospel competition, like a choir competition, and that was a category, was gospel choirs.
Yeah.
And we got up and sang, and the judges were like, they're singing too hard, they're gonna hurt their voices.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah. And our choir teacher's like, look, I don't know what to tell you. That's how you sing gospel music.
Because they were talking like Southern Baptist kind of gospel.
It was too passionate.
And we were, you know, our teacher was a black gospel singer, and he was amazing. That's what he taught us, and it was awesome. We were great. We were powerful, and we were
great.
That
was our best performance ever,
ever,
by the way.
Yes.
That was really good.
Isn't it great when you have somebody who's like a professional and what they do? They're just so good, and like you admire them, and then you get like some professional feedback and they just crap all over it like that.
Yeah.
Like he's just the best gospel singer I've ever met, but also, you know, a bunch of judges were like, no.
Judges that couldn't carry a tune if they had a bucket.
Right. It's not, they probably didn't sing. Yeah.
Shout out to Mr. Douglas. You are
Donald
awesome.
Douglas.
Yeah.
I am friends with him on Facebook. So, yeah. Mr. Douglas was just fantastic.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Oh, hey.
Good guy.
Yeah. Good shout out.
All right. What do we got next?
More birthdays.
Ooh, 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 ooh. 1939, Jacob gave me a good one. Spencer Davis is born in Swansea, Wales.
Ooh.
Oh, yes. Spencer Davis, of course, of the Spencer Davis Group, one of my favorite bands from the early 60s. Of course, they are most well known for one of the greatest songs ever made, and then, of course, played by the Blues Brothers for a very quick scene in a country bar called Gimme Some Lovin'.
Can we hear it?
I don't actually have.
We didn't pick
up
this one to listen to,
Jake didn't pick,
but I kind of want to listen to it anyway.
But it just goes do 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 do.
Well, my temperature's rising, got my feet on the floor. It's a great song.
It's really good.
And the Spencer Davis Group, I think, the best whitest R&B group ever.
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, it's Steve Winwood, like rocking out on keyboard and guitar, and then just those amazing vocals that he had, like from a stupid young age.
Hey, and they were only together for what, like 3 or 4 years?
It was a
pretty short time.
It was a short run that they did, but yeah, he.
Give me some loving.
Yeah, that, I mean, they just had such a great power for what they did. Yeah, one of my favorite groups.
Good call. I love
listening to them.
Good birthday.
All right, what else we got?
Well, one short decade later, the year 1949, Terrence Butler, a.k.a. Geezer Butler, bassist, lyricist for Black Sabbath, is born in Aston, Birmingham, England.
Birmingham.
Yeah, Geezer Butler, happy birthday.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Geezer.
That was a good one.
Yeah, and also his bass rig setup was, like, really cool because he always had that crazy distortion on his bass. Like, just really crunchy. Really crunchy.
I like that.
You're only a three-piece. You got to make noise somewhere.
That's true.
That, get that wall of sound.
All right, what do we got next?
Oh, it's a new day. July 18th. started out in 1993 when Rage Against the Machine protest music censorship by appearing at their Lollapalooza set in Philadelphia completely nude except for duct tape over their mouth. They refused to play any music and simply stand like statuesque bastards for 25 minutes with signs written with the letters PMRC referring to the Parents Music Resource Center.
Rage Against the Machine living up to their name there.
If I had bought a ticket to that, I would have been insanely pissed. However, now it's awesome.
It's like you would have, yeah, you would have been mad, but then it was like, oh no, I was there. Like now you would be, but I love Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
They're awesome. And you know, they still have kind of always kept the political edge.
Yeah.
You know, because it's got to be hard to, in a way, to be like a band who has a message, but then you also like get hit songs out of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because for some people, I'm sure they don't think of it as like what it is. They just listen to they're like, oh, this song rocks. But it, you know, that's got to be difficult.
That was the whole reason there were so many people inside of Chuck D's group.
What are you talking about? The new Prophets of Rage?
No, the old group.
Oh, Public Enemy?
Yeah, Public Enemy. How they had like the army of people with like fake Uzis dressed in camos and and the their media moguls that would speak out for them and stuff.
Yeah.
That was the whole Chuck D's whole thing was like there's plenty of people that are just going to listen to this missing the message.
I feel like we don't see too many musical protests these days. When's the last one you remember? I guess that band Pussy Riot over in Russia has been doing a lot of stuff.
Yeah, they do stuff. I've seen people
because they went on the field at the World Cup. They like rushed the field and did a protest just like last over the weekend.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't agree with his message, but like Ted Nugent is pretty charged at his shows.
Yeah, I guess that is one way to look at it, huh?
You know, It actually, like, he's kind of so bad at it that it would keep me from buying a ticket, but.
Yeah. I think, there's plenty of bands that people have said, like, well, I hope he doesn't be too preachy, like, before the show. What? Oh, gosh. Who would I saw somebody the other, like, not that long ago. It was the same situation.
I would say that's not really a protest, though. Like, this was them deliberately standing on stage and not doing anything in protest of something.
This is the most protesty of them all, stand there and don't do anything.
I think a protest, like, you know, somebody being on stage and then using that platform to get across a political message or whatever it happens to be, you know, that's them preaching, yes, but that's not a protest. I'd say, you know, a protest would be, you know, like a weird concert or something that somebody would put on like in front of the White House because they could.
Yeah.
Or tearing up a picture of the Pope on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. That would be I would count that as a protest definitely because a weirdly misplaced protest because that Pope was loved, but you know, I mean, I get why she did it, but it wasn't necessarily a representation of the Pope. It was just supposed to represent religion in general.
I don't know, man. John Paul gets a pass on a lot of things just because he's been dead for so long.
Yeah, but he was still a very much loved Pope.
It's interesting.
I think it's because nobody really, like, he didn't really say much.
It's interesting how those things get so misconstrued sometimes. Like you said, where it's like, well, I don't have anything against the Pope. It just symbolizes religion. And then everyone's like, oh, that's the Pope. How dare you, the Pope? How dare you love the Pope?
Also, if you remember what the John Paul II was, the last or like the only Pope to be a platinum selling artist as well as Grammy award winning artist.
That's right.
Yeah, Grammy award winning.
So there you go. I mean, that's
ladies and gentlemen, appearing now, Grammy award winning Pope, John Paul II.
I love John Paul.
The Polish prognosticator, Grammy award-winning, your holy father, the voice of the Lord Pope.
And appearing now on the drum kit.
Oh my God.
That's awesome.
That's so good. Woo. Well, oh man.
We should leave it on that high note. Yeah, let's do some birthdays.
Let's go on to some birthdays here. 1929. I put a spell on you. Screaming Jay Hawkins is born Jalisse Hawkins in Cleveland, Ohio.
And the best part about that dude is that moment that you love, Jake, where he's like, bah, wah.
He does that so well.
Yeah. Oh, your impression of that is so good.
Great.
So good. Okay, well, so another birthday. 1950, Glenn M. Hughes is born in New York City. Who is Glenn M. Hughes?
Sounds a little like this. Video is amazing.
So that was the Village People. Glenn M. Hughes, of course, being the biker from the group.
Wait,
if
he
you
was
will.
That guy. I don't remember that guy. Oh, he's like the construction worker.
Yeah,
because there's the cowboy, the construction worker, the Indian, the biker, the Navy guy.
Well, whenever they would change people, they would just bring in a new personality. So, like, there was a policeman, there was a Navy guy, there was an Army officer.
Yeah.
Usually just a uniform.
So, what did Glenn normally wear?
He was the leather guy.
He was the leather biker.
Okay, because this one, he's actually wearing, like, a military uniform. He's not...
No, not the lead singer. The baritone, the background singer.
Oh! So he's the biker. Yeah, okay,
wait,
in the background.
Just play, like, 2 seconds of that clip again. The baritone, you say.
Yeah.
The baritone.
He's really a lot of perk in the mix.
Go West.
Yeah, he had like the giant mustache, you know, that went all the way over.
Here's the funny thing. Whenever I was looking over these notes, for a second, I thought they meant Glenn Hughes from Kings of Chaos, Deep Purple, and Black Sabbath Glenn Hughes.
Like the more famous?
Yeah. And I was like, wait a second. It was like this mind-blowing
moment.
Thought
that like he also was like did well, a stint
yeah.
in Village People?
Yeah, I thought like, was he there for like a year? What? And then I looked it up and I was like, no, okay. Not the British guy, the biker guy.
I would like to point out that Glenn Hughes of the Village People tragically passed away in 1996.
Lung cancer.
Lung cancer, yeah. Mm. But they said he was so well known for his powerful bass voice that like it's just that everybody loved him. You know, he's like he worked with a bunch of different people and like for a bunch of different groups and stuff. And but yeah, like they said he was one of the greatest guys singing. So
yeah, if you look at his credits in there, he's worked with a lot of people as a session artist.
Oh, okay. Wait, he didn't die in 1996. He died in 2001. Sorry, at the age of 50.
Wow.
He said he has been interred wearing his Leatherman outfit.
Oh, that's great.
What a way to go.
Well, I mean, that was his claim to fame.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Good guy.
And a new
what
day.
What do we got next?
A new day.
Ooh. 1985.
Ooh.
Joan Jett.
This is July 19th.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
July 19th, 1985. Joan Jett places a phone call to the up-and-coming heavyweight boxer Mike Tyson before his fight with Larry Sims, which Tyson won very handily in the first round knockout. However, Tyson was so taken and with his performance in the fight and being a boxer and slightly superstitious, he insisted on talking to Joan Jett before every fight of his. for 31 straight fights up until his fight when he broke that tradition with James Buster Douglas in his first loss.
Ooh, he should have kept talking to Joan Jett.
No, he really should have, like, not changed his trainer and, like, prepared for the fight.
Oh, you mean actually prepare?
Well, that was an insane fight because, like, Buster Douglas, everyone thought was a real chump because he always had, like, weight problems and never didn't work real hard in training camp.
Mm-hmm.
And he came into that fight the lightest he had ever been and ready for it because, like, his mother had just passed away, like, 3 months before the fight. So he just dedicated himself to fighting.
He was, like, going in the gym just...
Yeah.
You gotta push it to the limit.
Meanwhile, like Tyson was just like
live
walking
to
in there.
Win.
Meanwhile, Tyson was like in the middle of a divorce and a whole bunch of other stuff, and thought, "Oh, I'm just
scandal."
Gonna, like,
and he was probably charges. Getting fast.
Yeah, I'm just gonna like walk over this guy, and I've got Don King and all these trainers that I'm paying money for to just tell me I'm the champion. And it was a terrible performance. And yeah, Douglas knocked him out.
I broke my back.
The world broke.
Finally.
So bad.
All right. Well, moving on up to the year 1986. Genesis have their first and only number one Hot 100 hit as Invisible Touch tops the charts.
Greatest intro in the history of recorded music right there. I love how they use the bass to change the key of the song. Like, right there in the intro, you don't even notice it because the melody stays the same. But you just move the bass and you move the chord, man. Love it.
I'm a fan of Genesis. I always have been. Being both iterations of Genesis. Just to let you know, though, Invisible Touch was on their 13th album.
Wow.
They kept cranking those suckers out.
I'm still dancing from that one.
Yes. I'm actually super excited. In October, I believe, I will be going to Cleveland or Columbus. I don't remember. One of those, Cleveland or Columbus, Ohio, to see Phil Collins on tour. So I'm looking forward to that. I've been a big fan of Phil Collins for a while. I'm a big fan of Peter Gabriel, too. And I'm a big fan of Genesis. I'm a big fan of that entire group.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I just watched the rerun of South Park where Phil Collins dupes everybody into being a fan of his.
Yeah. Well, you know why they did that, right? Because he got really, really pissed off at them. Because they won an award over him. And he was like, seriously, the cartoon guys? Or it was something for like Team America is like... World Police, like the something on there, like won an award over what
was it, like America? Fuck yeah,
probably
coming down to send the motherfucking, like that won like a Grammy over like a Phil Collins song.
It was like a movie score thing, and like his one got beat, and they won something, and so he got like super pissed off at them,
and like, so they turn around and did a whole episode making fun of him.
Yeah, that is literally what they did, like. I'm a fan of trolls, and so that's epic. I mean, it's like we have a platform to make fun of celebrities, and you want to come after us?
Yeah.
Really?
That's really funny. And
he walked into that one. That being said, I'm still a big fan of Phil Collins, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. So Face Value is still one of my all-time favorite albums.
Yeah, I got that one at home.
Dig it.
More birthdays.
Hey, got that, yeah. Actually, no. Wait, yeah, no, we are on birthdays. That's right. Okay, 1944, Commander Cody of Commander Cody and his lost planet airmen is born George Frayn IV in Boise, Idaho.
Boise. I like it when you say Boise, kind of like Joyzy.
Joyzy.
But it's Boise. Boise. Boise, Idaho. Anyways,
I apologize to anyone who's listening to this in headphones because of Greg's percussive.
What? Is it that bad? Boise.
Boise.
I'm telling you right now, somebody is ripping out at least, one earbud.
Like these. Never mind.
But sorry, I didn't realize I was doing that.
Oh, that's good. We've talked about Commander Cody before. Jake, you're a fan, so.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a fan of, like, anyone that has a shtick and then just stays with
you it. You are very much a fan of the shtick groups artists.
It's not the shtick itself. It's the dedication.
The dedication to the shtick.
Yes. Dedication to the shtick.
Yeah.
More shtick than you can shake a stick at.
I like that. All right, so let's move on to July 20th and close this week out. Starting off in the news, we have 1984, The Neverending Story, debuts in U.S. theaters featuring a theme song by former Kajagoogoo lead singer Limahl. Yeah, I got that pretty darn close.
Hush, hush.
Weirdly enough, the movie was I was two at the time when it was released, or it was two when we were two when it was released, Jake. But I remember that my parents told me the story later on that they took my brother to see the movie and he was terrified of the flying dog dragon.
Really?
Yes, terrified.
That I still have nightmares about that stupid wolf.
Yeah.
I'm 35 years old and I have nightmares about a fucking puppet.
Wow. You know, it's interesting that we're the people who do this show because, like, if you got three different people to come and talk about the Neverending Story, this conversation could go way different.
Yeah.
And just like, oh my gosh, do you remember this? You remember that? And instead, both of you were just like,
I liked it. I liked Neverending Story and I liked the sequel. So.
Good. See, I liked the movies. I never had an issue with them growing up. I think it was a little. There was a lot of stuff that did kind of freak you out as a kid, though.
Puppets can be terrifying, especially that movie. Because
wasn't there one part where like they said something about like you'd get frozen and turned to stone at one point?
Well, there was the Swamp of Sadness,
and there's the Swamp of Sorrow.
Yeah,
which is where the horse died.
Right.
Which is like one of the saddest scenes
ever. The horse just gave up.
And then it's like, you know, you just have like these young kids going to see this movie, and all of a sudden this horse just dies in this swamp, and you're like, no. I mean, like, that movie scarred children for life. I think one of the reasons why people our age are pretty cynical is because of that.
I think you're crazy.
I also think that the Generation X, like those who were, you know, born in like 80 plus, also believed that they could accomplish anything because we grew up with MacGyver and the A-Team. And we literally believe we can fix anything and get out of any situation.
With a toothbrush.
It's because we can.
Awesome.
Because we're geniuses.
So the Neverending Story, this yes. day in history.
Yeah, that's I didn't know anything about the song, actually. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and listen to the Limahl.
Yeah.
From Kajagoogoo.
Yeah. All right. So what do we got next?
I can't believe that this next one is already here.
Go ahead and take it then.
Well, I wasn't
already talking about it. Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay, well, in 2017, Chester Bennington of Linkin Park, age 41, was found dead. Suicide by hanging. Bennington was close friends with Chris Cornell, who died in a similar fashion 2 months earlier. So we'll pay a little tribute to him. His song has both.
Well, yes, but let's also get to the next factoid, though, which is that on that same day, it was also Chris Cornell's birthday.
Oh, yeah.
And he was born Christopher John Boyle in Seattle, Washington.
Oof.
And so here we go. This is Chris Cornell featuring Chester Bennington singing the song Hunger Strike. We'll be right back.
Oof.
Man, I wish we could play that entire performance. Because Chris Cornell, like, sits on the backseat of that whole song, like, letting Chester do all the screams and the, like, little runs with the stuff.
Yeah.
Which I think actually might have been improv, because he was hitting, like, he was going weird places with some of those notes that, like, you don't hear on the normal studio recording.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Chris Cornell comes in with that weird, like, cut in his voice where he goes into falsetto.
Yeah.
Which he almost never does, and it's just, it's like, it's a brilliant little run right there at the tail of the song.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, two of the best power vocalists of our generation right there, and we lost them in a very short period of time, and, like, it was not a good time, like, last year.
Yeah, that was this time last year. It was crazy.
It was not a good time. Mm. But, The one thing we always take solace in whenever it comes to losing an artist or a band or whatever it happens to be is that, yes, they are gone, but their music is still with us and we can still enjoy it to this day. So, yeah.
Like we just did.
Yeah.
Yep.
That still hurts, actually. I still don't like that one.
Why? Why do you think it is that, like, these two specifically were so big of a deal? Like, cause I mean, we get celebrity deaths all the time, but, I mean, was it just the fact that they both just had such powerful voices and were,
I think it comes out of how dystopian music was from that era. Like the 90s grunge phase.
Yeah. The emotionalism of it.
Yeah. Pretty much everyone died young. Mm. Right. But then we had, you know, Chris Cornell come out of that, who was still like the 70s version of a rock god, still doing it. He, like, Soundgarden, Temple of the Dog, they were the only bands that were still going on. And he, not only that, but he was also plugged into Hollywood and he was doing stuff for soundtracks. What was the song from Fast and the Furious? One of the Fast and Furious. I don't remember. But, yeah, you know, so he was just kind of everywhere, and you just sort of took it for granted, like, oh, that's the one that's going to make it.
I really loved Chris Cornell when he did Heavy as the Head with Zac Brown Band, because that was like, I mean, he had his solo album that he put out just right before his death, but that was like one of the last big singles that he also worked on leading up to it. That was a kick-ass song, though, that bass line.
Yeah.
So. Well, gone but not forgotten.
No.
And we've got one left, fellas.
We do have one birthday left, yeah. It's kind of funny that we're going to actually end on this, but Jake, I think it's also kind of a nice thing to do because...
Are you going
to
play us out? Please tell us you're going to play us out on this.
Oh, for her song?
I think you should, because it's the perfect, like, fade out the show.
Let's see.
Ladies and gentlemen, just wait. We're working on this here.
Yeah, yeah, okay, here we go.
It's going to be perfect.
So, I don't know, it's got a weird intro to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can talk over it, because on this day, 1972, in Bridgeport, in Old Bridge Township, New Jersey, one Colleen Ann Fitzpatrick, otherwise known as Vitamin C, was brought screaming into the world.
So, yeah, this is what I like.
This was my 8th grade... commencement song. No.
I don't remember any of these lyrics.
I remember the chorus. Wait,
chorus.
Here we go.
Here we go. No, it's still not the chorus yet.
I'm still slow dancing in the 8th grade gym. Gentlemen, this is Ben. Follow the sound.
Oh, God. Remember, folks, if you want to help out our podcast, please go to followthesoundpodcast.com and click on the Amazon banner on the right-hand side, or just go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Or you can go to yoradio.com and listen to all the great music that we have on there that is completely and totally free, probably does not include this song or this album or anything involving Vitamin C, But go and check that out. Download it at Google Play and on iTunes and enjoy. This has been Follow the Sound. I have been your host, Brian Kroc. Along with me has been Jacob Crum.
Wherever you go, there you are.
And Greg Harvey.
We remember graduation.
And remember, folks, if you hear it, follow the sound.
Boise.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.